If there's one book you're sure to see on the beach, on the subway, in fact, everywhere this summer, it's a Stieg Larsson novel with one of those distinctive covers featuring the quirky computer hacker Elizabeth Salander and Michael Blomqvist, the intrepid journalist. Now the final installment of the Millennium Trilogy, which began with The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo and continued with The Girl Who Played with Fire, has been released. It's called The Girl Who Kicked the Hornet's Nest. And joining me now to discuss the books are their American publisher, Sonny Mehta, chairman and editor-in-chief of Knopf, Doubleday, and Paul Bogards, executive vice president and executive director for publicity. I'm very pleased to welcome them to our show. Hello.
Hi.
So how much of the popularity of the novels has to do with the main character, Elizabeth Salander, and how much of it has to do with the fact that a runaway bestseller owes its success to the fact that it's a runaway bestseller?
Well, I think a lot of it has got to do with Elizabeth Salander. I think she's such an original, unique sort of heroine. I mean, one for our times. It's someone who's effectively been victimized by society but does not feel herself a victim. And who, really does feel that she's in control of everything that happens to her.
Mm-hmm. Well, didn't Stieg Larsson say that he conceived Elizabeth Salander as something like an updated version of Pippi Longstocking? It's hard for me to imagine a Pippi Longstocking who's a tattooed bisexual, but... I guess that's the way that people connect to her.
I think they do. And then, of course, go back to your original question, I mean, I think she was the main thing. And her relationship with a more conventional character, foil, which was Mikkel Blomqvist. One is, of course, a computer hacker and very much a 21st century person, and Blomqvist is a sort of a crusading journalist, very much sort of the green eye shade and the rest of this, and part of what people now talk about as old media, and they make an extraordinary a couple.
And it's pronounced Mikkel in Sweden?
I'm not an authority on Swedish. I'm sure people will phone in.
One writer said about the books that, I'm quoting, much of the pleasure of reading Larsson lies in getting righteously angry on Salander's behalf.
I think that has a lot to do with it. And there is a lot to get angry about. I mean, she's had a heck of a life.
She's had a rough life. Can we assume that Stieg Larsson based the other main character, Mikkel Blomqvist, on himself?
I think that's the assumption. I don't know how true it is, but I was reading something just the other day that suggested actually that that did suggest that that much of the action, certainly in the first book, is taken from real life cases. In other words, he follows a documentary sort of approach.
Based on his journalistic experiences.
Based on his journalistic experiences. So, for instance, the rape that Elizabeth Salander endures is based on a real live case in Stockholm and things of that sort. But whether Blomqvist is actually based on him is something I couldn't. I never met him, unfortunately. Mm. I would have loved to. But
in fact, that must have made publishing these books a little more difficult because you usually. Can't, at least new books, you can usually talk to the author and get a sense of how to promote them. Wouldn't that be the case, Paul?
Well, it would help if we had an author to work with, but that
you can't do the book tour either.
But the backstory has proved exceptionally interesting to readers around the world. I don't think that's the reason why the books have become the global phenomenon they have become, but certainly. If you're looking at Stieg's life and you're looking at Michael's life in the novels, there are parallels between Stieg and Mikkel Blomqvist. The magazine that...
Oh, you're saying Michael. Okay.
Well, the magazine that he edits in the books, Millennium, is a parallel for Expo, the magazine that he worked on beginning in the 1990s, and the issues that Millennium chooses to tackle are the same ones that Stieg tackled as a journalist, a crusading journalist in Sweden. He also worked for the periodical Searchlight, which is a British-based international periodical which tries to expose fascism and ultra-right politics around the world. So that story has been an enduring component of the reporting on the books as the years have progressed. And one of the things, Leonard, that's interesting is that there are some readers who don't know that Larson is dead. And as a public relations professional, I still get queries from people in the media wanting to interview Stieg Larsson.
I don't want to give away too much of the novels for the 20-odd listeners who haven't read any of them or seen any of the movies, but the books paint a much darker picture of Sweden than I've ever imagined. Instead of this wonderful welfare state with the highest standard of living in the world, this Sweden is filled with fascists, malicious corporations, violence that targets women, and you say that they were the things that he covered as well.
It sounds a lot like America. I mean, the country that he's writing about, and I think again that's another part of the trilogy's enormous appeal around the world is that there are subjects that are immediately recognizable to readers.
I'm talking with Paul Bogaerts and Sonny Mehta about the Stieg Larsson books and their great success. Sonny, is fascism still an issue that's alive and well in Sweden? I always thought that was the problem for its neighbor Norway and Knut Hamsun and all of that.
Well,
Quisling.
Well, clearly, it is in the broader sense, certainly as reflected by this book, but I'm just thinking about other sort of crime writers coming out of Scandinavia one way or the other, and they're concerned with the way their ideal society is moving. Whether it's Henning Mankell or any of the other very, very distinguished Swedish writers who we're now sort of paying greater attention to.
Well, in the past, the darkness of Sweden had to do with the fact that there wasn't much sunlight and that and that Ingmar Bergman always seemed to have these rather troubled people who just couldn't get along. But that was more of a psychological thing than the sort of thing that Stieg Larsson is writing about.
Well, Stieg is writing about a society which as among other things, is suffering from great waves of immigration and stuff like that. And I suspect one of the reasons why it is people are talking about it in Sweden right now is the fallout from sort of the EU, the breakup of the Soviet Union, waves of people trying to find a better life outside whichever sort of country they originated from within the old Soviet Union and so on and so forth. So. Clearly, there are strains and stresses in Sweden, and as there are in other parts of Western Europe.
And it must be rather dangerous. I've heard that because he covered fascist groups, he had a fear of reprisals, and that was one of the reasons that he never married his longtime partner.
Right. If you marry in Sweden, you need to declare a permanent address, and he never wanted to declare a permanent address. So they were. They effectively had a common law marriage, although in Sweden that's not something that's practiced. And as a lot of your listeners are probably familiar with, there has been some fallout from the fact that Eva Gabrielsson and Stieg Larsson, who were together for 30 years, Eva is right now not entitled to any of the monies, any of the proceeds from the novels around the world.
So it's not just Sweden that applies to. It's any money that – any royalties from sales in the United States as well?
Yeah. All the royalties, all the monies are being managed by Jochen and Erland Larsson, who are respectively, the brother and father of Stieg, who still live under very modest circumstances in Umeå in northern Sweden, which is where Stieg spent most of his childhood growing up.
Well, there was an article in the Sunday Times magazine which looked into this whole story, and one of the suggestions was that she actually wrote the books or at least edited them so thoroughly that they became a lot better than they might have been, because Stieg Larsson had a reputation for not being one of the best stylists in Sweden, and everybody seemed to be rather surprised when the first novel came out.
Well, Chip, who wrote that piece in the Times magazine, effectively called her on that.
Now, and this is Chip Kidd.
Chip McGrath, who wrote the piece for the New York Times magazine. He sat down with Eva Gabrielsson, had a long conversation with her, and he asked her point blank, did you write these books? And she said, no, of course not. But what she was insinuating was that her life with Stieg possibly informed his work on the trilogy. At least that was my reading of that narrative. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, any couple that's been together for 30 years, I mean, that's not an illogical assumption.
Especially when she's an editor and he's a writer. You assume that, well, in some couples, they never show each other manuscripts, but in other couples, they come to you, Sonny, fully edited by the spouse or the girlfriend or the partner or whatever.
I have no idea what goes on with other people. I know that my wife, who occasionally writes.
A wonderful writer.
Never shows me a thing until the proofs arrive or something like that. But I don't know what went on over there. But I do believe that that he may not have been the most perfect writer. But, he was a tremendous storyteller. And I think that's the driving force of this trilogy, and what has made it work internationally is just the sheer storytelling of it all.
She does have a book coming out in the fall in France in which she's going to tell her story. Up until now, she's been rather tight-lipped, hasn't she?
Well, I wouldn't say that she's been tight-lipped. She has spoken to a number of journalists and made her point of view on this issue well known.
Well, she does think she deserves a piece of the prophets.
I can't speak for her, but in the articles I've read where she has been quoted, I think what she really wants is to manage the Larsson estate. She is concerned about how his work is being perceived around the world.
The books describe violence against women in great detail. Why do you think Stieg Larsson decided to go into that kind of detail?
I think that one of the driving impulses, he did. The original title for the first book was Men Who Hate Women. And I think one of his abiding passions was the way men treated women. And I was very, very conscious of basically of violence against women, both physical, but in the more abstract sense too.
Should I assume that English language version, The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, that title was brought in because Men Who Hate Women is not the most commercial of all titles?
Was
it changed in other translations or only in English?
I believe the Swedes changed it too, but I could be wrong about that. I know the English certainly did, and it came to us with that title.
I think that when the book was published in Sweden in August 2005, it did carry the title Men Who Hate Women. Stieg felt very – it's the one thing he was kind of uncompromising about.
Mm. He fought for it against
his publisher. He fought with Eva Geddon, who was his editor at Norstedts. He wanted that title. He felt very strongly, and in fact, it is a rip. It's a rip from one of the pages of the books. I can't remember which book, but it is a direct quote from one of the books about men who hate women. So it is clearly something that he reported out on in his life as a journalist – and adds to the kind of propulsive nature of these novels. I mean, the fact that, what happens to Lisbeth is absolutely horrific.
The cover design for the American version is very distinctive. And very different from the UK covers. I don't know about the Swedish covers. They have, the English covers have a hint of the darkness of the novels, and you have avoided that.
Well, we were introducing what at that stage was a completely unknown, well, in the first instance, it was a book as opposed to a trilogy of books. And I thought that they were really a great deal more interesting than your average sort of crime novel might be. And I wanted to make the covers more suggestive than I felt the British jacket was, which was really essentially, it was the naked shoulder seen from the back of a woman with a dragon tattoo on it, which was basically just replicating the title, essentially. I wanted it to be what I actually think the trilogy is, which is more than just a trilogy of crime novels.
Mm-hmm. You didn't want this to just be a thriller.
I didn't want it to be perceived as purely a genre product.
And he did. I mean, Sonny, working with Peter Mendelsohn and Carol Carson, they agonized over the process to get this cover right. They went through 50 versions of the jacket. And so what you end up with is a design that is not genre and has become iconic in and of itself.
Oh, we recognize, we spot it in the subway, and we know somebody's reading one of these books. But it's also, I'm assuming, a way of getting past the fact that some people just won't read thrillers, but they might read a book that seems to have a broader
theme. Was, we wanted to get everybody who reads thrillers too, but we did really want to reach out for as broad an audience as possible, and we were fortunate that Peter came up with this design that went on, well, it's won an award and stuff like that.
My guest is Sonny Mehta, chairman and editor-in-chief of Knopf Doubleday, and Paul Bogarts, executive vice president and executive director for publicity at Knopf Doubleday. We're talking about the Stieg Larsson Millennium Trilogy. There may be a fourth book, but we'll get to that. The books were already a hit in Sweden and throughout Europe. Did you think from the start that they could become bestsellers here as well?
I wanted them to desperately, but you know, this is not always the most hospitable country to foreign writing. So there was always a question mark about that, and that was one of the things that we were very conscious of. It had been a long time since there'd been a novel of foreign origin that had been. You can always name them. I mean, there was one we were thinking about, A Smell, A Sense of Snow, I think, and mm-hmm. before that, there was probably The Name of the Rose, but it's about one every 15 years, as far as I can make out.
Last week we had Edith Grossman and some other translators on the show talking about the fact that translations are down. New translations are down in this country because it's hard to sell them. Why do you think that is?
I think that there is more curiosity, actually. Ironically, I think there's more curiosity about foreign writing, as there is about foreign countries of places, and in the America that we're publishing in now, than it was, you know, when I came to work over here about 20 odd years ago.
There's from England.
But are
many books not being translated in England as they are here?
I think, well, if people like Edie Grossman are saying, commenting on this, it's a sign of perhaps where publishing is going as much as anything mm-hmm. else. But I think they're not as receptive over here to foreign writing as they are, say, in England.
When you're, Paul, when you are talking to people in the media about a book that's in translation, do you face a certain amount of resistance?
No, I not so much on the media side of things. I think that, there's a small subset of colleagues in the media who are receptive to the notion of foreign writers. We work with Penn, the Penn Festival, the Foreign Writers Festival, which takes place every year in the spring. So there are, I mean, that's not where the pushback comes from so much. It's just more of retailers might be somewhat hesitant to bring in big numbers, which is why when we originally published book one, The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, we had to take a very aggressive position on the book. And it may have been a work in translation by a dead Swedish crime novelist, but that did not stop us from, you know, putting out ARCs and putting forward a first printing of over 100,000 copies with a very aggressive advertising campaign, with an online campaign. And not that these are a guarantee that the book's going to perform in the marketplace, but that support was there from day one, and it made a difference with our retail partners.
Well, when you're doing a translation, you're paying twice. You're paying for the book, and then you're paying for the translator. And I remember some years back, you came up with a much better new translation of Thomas Mann's probably one of his most famous novel.
We did War and Peace.
We did War and Peace a few years ago.
By Pivar.
Yeah. But Mon didn't sell all that well, despite the fact that it's one of the great classics.
But War and Peace did. War and Peace sold over 80,000 copies in hardcover for us, which was huge.
I guess the answer is people are more interested in reading Tolstoy than Thomas Mann. But still, it's a major commitment, isn't it, to commission a new translation?
It is. But on the other hand, if you are doing a new translation of War and Peace, it's a translation which the book is going to be read as it has been for a long, long time, and the new translation
and
is going to be read.
And people read Magic Mountain
for,
in 20 years, too,
well, they
50 years.
They absolutely will. So it's an investment, which is the answer to your question.
The trilogy came rather late to the United States. It had already sold 3.5 million copies in Sweden alone, and that's a country with a population of 9 million. So over a third of the people in the country had bought the book. There was they're the three top-selling novels in Germany last year. They've been published in 35 countries, and they were published in England before the United States?
They were. The translations that we published were commissioned by the British publisher from whom we did buy the rights. I just wanted to have everything firmly in place as far as our publication was concerned. It's traditional in any case that there's always a gap of some sort or the other. Sometimes it's a couple of months, sometimes it's even, it could be longer. And in this particular case, I just wanted to make sure that we had all the reads in, that people were beginning to recognize how important this thing was for us.
We published on a 9-month cycle. We published the first book in September of 2008. So we're not even 2 years into the process, and we've sold in aggregate across all formats 6.9 million copies of Stieg's work. And the most exciting thing is on a week-to-week basis, Lenny, more readers are coming to the books, and specifically more readers are coming to the first book.
And now Larson's books have outsold Harry Potter in France. I'm assuming that there are certain similarities between the two phenomena. No?
Well, that was a YA phenomenon. So you had children reading the books and then parents reading the books with their children. This is an adult trade phenomenon.
We're pretty much out of time, but I wanted to get to the matter of the placement of the apostrophe that caused so much controversy in the New York Times. Why did you move the apostrophe on hornets from the plural, which is there's a lot of hornets in a nest, to this, which sounds like there's one hornet in this whole nest?
We had a big, big debate about it. And then finally, I had to make a Solomonic decision, and that's really how it came about.
Well, this is probably a hornet's nest in a whatever. Sonny Maida, chairman and editor-in-chief of Knopf Doubleday, Paul Bogart's executive vice president and executive director for publicity at Knopf. Thank you so much for being with us. On tomorrow's show, the film Countdown to Zero looks at atomic proliferation and some of the terrifying nuclear near misses that you've probably never heard of. We'll be talking to two of the documentary's creators, along with Valerie Plame Wilson, who's featured in the film. Then 81-year-old jazz piano legend Barry Harris. Also, Venda Levita on her new novel, The Lovers. Plus, New Yorker editor David Remnick and longtime writer Roger Angel discuss the art of sports writing. The Leonard Lopate Show is produced by Blakeney Schick, Stephen Valentino, and Julia Corcoran. Melissa Egan is the executive producer, and we had help today from Carrie Barber, Andrew Katchen, Johanna Barr, and Jessica Ramey. Debbie Fanta was at the audio controls. I'm Leonard Lopate, your host. Thanks for listening. We'll see you at noon tomorrow.